It's my pleasure to welcome today Panu Minkkinen from the University of Helsinki to our short conversations with legal theorists or legal thinkers series. I've been asking our guest to say a few words as a way of introduction.
And it's lovely to talk to you across all these kilometers. I don't even know how far away we are from each other, but it's a long, long way, all the way from Northern Europe to the northwestern end of the North American continent. In terms of personal history, I guess I'm very much a sort of normal bloke like everybody else, in the sense that I went to law school. I found it boring. But then I, for one reason or another, I found out that I'm pretty good at research, I'm pretty good at teaching. And that's how I grew my roots into academia, into the university world. I mean, within that, of course, there are still quite a lot of options. And then you can ask, why didn't I become a contract lawyer, where you probably make a lot more money? So why did I become a legal theorist or a jurisprude? I guess that has then more to do with simply the types of things that interested me at the time. And so if I wanted to somehow work with themes that really interested me and that I had a passion for, there wasn't really anything else on offer in the law school except jurisprudence. So contract law was not my thing, and I was not theirs. With contract law, it was a two-way love affair in that sense. I sort of more or less organically drifted into jurisprudence. And like I said, one of the things that I did realize during my studies, and especially during the dissertation phase, and also my senior colleagues realized, that I had the knack for the things that especially research work required, which patience. Research is not instant gratification, as you will know. Projects, they take quite a long time, and you have to see them through. And then also pedantism. I'm a bit pedantic, and I think that sort of serves you well if you want to make this thing into a profession, as far as the research is concerned. But teaching as well, I think sort of in student feedback, the nicest compliment I've got is inspired and inspiring, meaning that the students, they pick up that I'm genuinely passionate about what I teach, and then that sort of catches on. It's infectious, so that helps me at the teaching front. It's a sort of enjoyable profession for me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, in fact, about your role as a teacher of jurisprudence or theory. And in fact, do you prefer the name jurisprudence or legal theory or philosophy? How do you characterize also your own approach to the field?
I think this is a legitimate question even for the students to ask, mm-hmm. because sometimes they may feel that a compulsory course in jurisprudence is not what they need. So this is their sort of like initial intuition. And I think it's our responsibility as teachers to convince them that this is not the case. So we have a couple of responses that we can give them. A few have to do with just what is jurisprudence, what is its place in the law school. Now, jurisprudence in my native Finnish, because our sort of tradition is Germanic, basically, it's not even called jurisprudence because that's a Latin-based word. But from the German, it's more like my chair is called Professor of General Studies of Law, which seems to imply that there are sort of general questions that relate to all areas of law. And that's the sort of area that jurisprudence covers. So, for example, how do various human rights instruments affect the interpretation of legal norms in areas like contract law, criminal law, administrative law, and so forth. So it's a general question, and the general studies in law basically deals with those. And then the students, once they have learned these general sort of doctrines, if you will, they can take them to their sort of individual exams and also sort of the way in which they learn the more specific disciplines within the law school. I think the other notion of jurisprudence with which I'm perhaps a bit more comfortable with nowadays is that jurisprudence provides all these contexts in which law by necessity operates, so be they political, social, cultural, economic, today perhaps even technological. So there are a number of different contexts in which law operates, and the aim of jurisprudence in this sense is to give a more sort of rounded view of law in its different contexts. I think that one of the things that is often missed here is that jurisprudence is also a key element in what's called a liberal legal education. Of course, liberal here has nothing to do with political views. It's not sort of liberalism as a political view. It has to do with employability. And this is something that perhaps some impatient students don't realize. In today's world, in today's really, really competitive labor market, you have to have skills which go beyond the traditional lawyering skills. You have to be able to accommodate yourself into a world that has NGOs, international organizations. You have to be able to sort of function as a lobbyist. And if you look at the way in which lawyers are situated in the labor market, I think you get sort of diverse or diversified view of what we as lawyers do in this particular time of history than simply the straightforward attorney slash judge job, which seems to form the template of legal education. And I think the jurisprudence course plays an important role in this sort of this idea of a liberal legal education that provides these sort of transferable skills, if you will, that allow the law student now graduated to gives her much more options on the labor market, on the job market, than a very sort of straightforwardly tuned education through legal clinics.
Yeah, I wanted to also ask you about your own particular approach to the discipline and whether you situate yourself in a particular context within the discipline. How would you define that?
I have to admit that it's been a bit sort of like wavering. It's been in a bit of a flux. I guess that's a good point, isn't it? It's it's sort of like it's good that it has. Part of it comes from critical self-reflection, in the sense that I've come to the conclusion maybe that some of the early work that I did was a bit navel-gazing, you know, sort of conceptual navel-gazing, which might have served some purposes and so forth, but it didn't really resonate with the world around me, in the sense that I could have contributed to things like social justice and what have you. I don't imagine that my work has any such big effect now, but let's put it this way, at least I'm contributing towards it in my own sort of small way. And so from that earlier, I did sort of very conceptual work. I spent a year in Paris as a doctoral student. So when I was working on my PhD with a French philosopher called Jacques Derrida, that was quite a sort of life-changing experience. So I went there with a research plan for a doctoral thesis. I spent a year in Paris, and the only sort of result that came out of that was that I tore the plan up. I mean, it was rubbish. I just realized that it was rubbish. Today, I think my orientation within the sort of, I mean, jurisprudence, there are a number of different approaches. You have the standard positivists, you have critical approaches, you have the law and humanities approaches, and so forth. I would say that broadly speaking, in the broadest possible sense, I think that I'm sort of gravitating little by little more towards areas which are socio-legal. And if I look at the latest work that I'm doing, it's somehow trying to incorporate an idea of ethnology into the study of law and the legal world. Ethnology sort of like from a slightly critical point of view, I don't like the word postmodern, but this is the word that North American authors often use of the authors that I find myself referring to all the time. But nevertheless, it's sort of ethnology seems to be sort of like the one of the words that pops up in my work a lot. I mean, it's more ethnology is more like an approach to, and then there are a couple of different topics that I use that approach to analyze.
And now that you're talking about ethnology, I guess the cultural context is very important, also the rootedness within those cultures. And you've mentioned already you were spent a year in Paris, but you spent many years also in England and of course in Finland. So I was curious to see how those different contexts have shaped your understanding of law and your own approach to law. You can tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, sure. Especially if we talk about England. I was just corresponding today with one of my former colleagues in Leicester. He's Italian. And we both lamented how little we understand the English still after all these years. And Yulan, you're a Basque from Spain, and I understand you more than I understand any of the English colleagues that I had, even if I was working with them, you know, very closely. I think there might be a way of explaining why it's so difficult to sort of bridge that abyss between me and my friends and colleagues, especially in England. Once again, Scotland is a different, totally different world, as is Wales too. So not to mention Ireland and what have you. But nevertheless, I think sort of there's a certain truth to what Max Weber said about how the continental Europeans, the civil law countries, how they view law and how the Anglo-American, the common law tradition views law. So for us continentals, law is more like a science. We look at it in terms of it being structured like a science and our view being the scientific gaze of the academic with which we dissect the whole world of law. I mean, of course, it doesn't work in that way in real life, but nevertheless, that's the ideal of law that we've been taught at law school. You know, sort of we get these conceptual apparatus with which we're supposed to then be able to identify a system of law, the positivistic sort of ideal. Whereas the common law sort of tradition identifies law more with an art or with a practice. Mm-hmm. You don't learn it through books. You learn it through experience. You learn it through apprenticeships with experienced lawyers. So it's something you pick up rather than learn as a science. So Weber made this distinction, and even though there was a bit of a blind spot in what he was saying, because of course his way of presenting the two views in this way is clearly a continental European way. I mean, the dichotomy, right? But nevertheless, there's a certain truth to that, and I think this is one of the reasons why I have problems. But it has, obviously, all mobility is good mobility. So even for your students, you know, who are in Canada, sort of once we get rid of the travel restrictions, etc., I encourage you to use all the exchange possibilities that you do have, because that from a professional point of view, it is so enriching. It is challenging in a positive way and will pay off multifold after the trip. In that sense, yes, I came back a very sort of different person, very sort of developed person, even though the basic feeling still today is one of perplexion. Not really understanding who they are and what they do and why they think the way in which they do.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to switch gears a little bit and ask you about the richness of your interdisciplinary work, and you're mentioning sociolegal studies, you're mentioning the work of Max Weber, but you've also done quite a lot of continental philosophy, and you're doing ethnology, you're doing literary studies as well. What's the value that you see in interdisciplinarity, and what has meant for you to develop that interdisciplinary approach?
It depends a bit on which role we talk about, whether as a teacher or as a researcher. As you'll know yourself, and probably sort of all the students realize too, we have a bit of a schizophrenic role in the sense that we're expected to do very international and interdisciplinary research, but that doesn't translate very easily to sort of skills that we can teach. So what we do is that we live one life as a researcher and then another life as a teacher. And I think sort of like in the medical school, they probably have to do a similar sort of schizophrenic dualism, or live this type of dual life, this divided life in a similar sort of way. But nevertheless, in my view, as a researcher, the different disciplines, they all come from the research questions that you're mm-hmm. pursuing. So it's not like you don't choose the discipline or the method first. Mm-hmm. You don't go like, oh, I'll be a positivist, and then sort of, what can I do with this? You somehow come up with a research question, and it might very well be that your qualifications somehow limit your research questions or direct them into certain areas, but usually only to a certain extent. And then you realize that the existing qualifications that I have, they're not enough for this, so I have to upgrade my qualifications by taking on social theory, sociology, ethnology, whatever it happens to be for that particular project. And that's how you come up with these projects that the outside world views as being multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary. But I think there's also sort of like one misconception about that type of, I would say, multidisciplinary work rather than interdisciplinary work. I mean, the different approaches and disciplines that you use, they don't necessarily agree amongst each other. You know, like if you approach something as a lawyer and then you use social theory in it as well, you might come up with contradictory sort of statements and results. But that's not a weakness. You're not supposed to force the two sort of views together in such a way that there's no contradiction. You're supposed to work through the contradictions and see if that brings about something interesting. So let's say that you, for example, look at human rights from a sort of purely legal point of view. Human rights are simply the positive instruments that have been passed on by a legislator mm-hmm. Or ratified by. But then you also take on a more social sciences oriented or humanities oriented view of human rights, which would probably underline the normative value of human rights a bit more. I mean, the two views don't necessarily have to gel together. You have to be able to use the contradicting views that come about as a strength, and be, because it reveals something. It reveals those contradictions. They reveal something both about, maybe in this particular example, about law and the way in which law views things, but also about how underdeveloped the view of some other disciplines is of law. You know, they have a sort of simplified view of law. They all, they think we're all technocrats. You know, they approach you and then they ask you, oh, we've got this problem with the will. Can you help me? And you try to tell them, no, listen, I'm a university researcher and a teacher. I don't do wills. But nevertheless, I think that's the sort of like main idea about the, and why sort of like I do multidisciplinary work. It's because it's required, the research questions, the research problems that I'm trying to work out require certain qualifications that I then have to get sort of at least some acquaintance with. Mm-hmm. And it sometimes takes quite a long while.
I want to go down the memory lane a little bit and talk a bit about your early work that you alluded to, but that was my first contact with your work, in fact, and so you wrote a beautiful book called Thinking Without Desire, and one of the terms that you coined there was the term of minor jurisprudence. So I wanted to ask you a bit about that term and what you meant by minor jurisprudence, but also a general question about Thinking Without Desire, and what was the idea behind the book? What is that you were trying to say?
Both are references. They're references that are sort of, shall we say, they're plays on words or references, but I'll explain both. The whole idea of minor jurisprudence came from a book that was written on the author, Franz Kafka, by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, called minor literature. They called Kafka's literature minor literature. And with that, they meant that it's literature that escapes all attempts to box it into classifications like literary genre or style. So it's slippery in the sense that you couldn't box it in. And of course, Kafka was also a practicing insurance lawyer, and he wrote extensively about law as well in his fiction. In working out some of Kafka's themes about law, I sort of took then the idea or sort of the analogy that his ideas on law were, in a similar way as his literature was minor literature, was sort of also minor jurisprudence, in the sense that you can't really sort of box his views into any of the existing disciplinary categories that we have for legal thinking. And in that particular case, it was especially evident in the penal colony, the short story, which I would insist that every law student reads at one point or another, even your class. Everyone should read the penal colony before they begin the jurisprudence course. The other, Thinking Without Desire, that's a passage from the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle, which is much later on, so after my book, was also sort of quoted in Legally Blonde, the film, with Reese Witherspoon. Her professor, in the first opening words at Law 101 or whatever, when she's in Harvard, is this quote from Aristotle that says that law is thinking without desire. So the idea that this little passage seems to be implying is that law is a sort of purely formal operation, completely unclouded by the lawyer's personal views or aspirations. Somehow bracket out desires altogether, and that's what law is. So in the book, I think I claim quite the contrary, that legal thinking always desires something, that it, mm-hmm. this desire can be seen as extending towards some sort of truth. But truth is out of its grasp. Law does not reach truth, but instead it sort of settles for what is right. That was the claim that I made in the book, that law can never reach truth. I don't know if anything can, I mean, sort of thing is, but that was the whole idea of the first philosophy of law, in the sense mm-hmm. that it cannot address truth. The only thing that it can do is decide on what is right, which is not a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not sort of nothing at all. It's actually sort of like quite a lot. But nevertheless, that was the idea behind the expression of thinking without desire.
And I want to talk a little bit more about your current work, which has been dealing quite a lot with political constitutionalism and theories of democracy and what you call agonistic democracy. Why is that critical concern relevant for you in the contemporary times?
I think most constitutionalists would not regard my work as constitutionalism, not political or what, because I'm not a great believer in liberal democracies. So I'm a bit, unfortunately, a bit further left from that. But I'll sort of slightly rephrase your question, but respond nevertheless. I think at this particular moment, what I'm trying to do, I have a sort of focus on how lawyers and judges, what their sort of roles in democracy are, in the sense that in the traditional liberal model, their roles are quite, shall we say, passive, or they're expected to be rather passive, in the sense that the courts or the judiciary, its role is simply to apply the law in individual cases without much interest in other aspects. Now, the thing that I'm working on at this particular moment is to try and work out a scheme with which to explain that no, both the judiciary as a branch of the state, but also lawyers in general, have a much more active role in sort of democracy without turning into activists. So it's not like the courts are activist courts or the lawyers are activist judges. I'm simply saying that once human rights have been incorporated into the main body of law, it by necessity makes all lawyers and the judiciary parts of a democratic mechanism, part of a political democratic mechanism. And the visual cues that we get of this is, for example, the individual young law students and lawyers sitting at JFK Airport on the ground with their laptops and filling in these applications or appeals for denied access to the country for the individuals. Or I'm trying to say that they're not necessarily sort of activists, these individuals. I mean, I have nothing against it if they want to sort of call themselves activists. But I would say that the law nowadays actually would require them to work in that way. So, for example, some of the decisions that the courts in the United States have made, even the Supreme Court, some of the decisions that it has, despite its makeup, its current makeup that it has made, are decisions that result from what law is like. I think this is more evident in Europe, where the European Convention and also the sort of like human rights that are embedded in the main documents of the EU, I think they have had like a profound effect on the way in which law functions in the member states. So this might not be as visible on the North American continent as it is in the EU, but nevertheless, here you can see it. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm especially interested in the judiciary, but by extension, I'm also interested in how it affects the work of lawyers, how it affects the legal education that we're supposed to provide future lawyers, how it's supposed to sort of work, because it's not a technical operation anymore. This is the thing. I mean, law used to be very simple. Simply, you had a rule, then you had the circumstances, and then you simply applied the rule to the individual circumstances, and you got, you know, sort of like, you got the result at the other end. It's a much more complicated system nowadays, with a lot of different principles at play, some principles even contradictory, and there's a lot of weighing that needs to be done by the individual actors, the individual lawyers, the individual law students, the judiciary, and so forth. So I think that's sort of like where the political theory comes in, that's where the theory of democracy comes in, and so forth.
All right, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to continue our conversations in the future, and just want to thank you again for talking to our class.
It was a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you and all your students at one point or another, once we can travel again.